The time is 9 a.m. p.m. It's Friday, May 24th, 1985. The place is the audio studio in the MSU Livingston Lord Library. The oral history agreement form giving ownership of this tape to the Northwest Minnesota Historical Center has been signed by interviewee and interviewer. The length of the interview will probably be about 90 minutes. Now, to complete this introductory record, Margaret, will you give your full name, your address, your position, your family, and what you are doing now?
I'm Margaret Nordley. I live at 1516 19 Half Street South in Sunray Condominium. I'm not married. I retired from Concordia Library in 1977, but I've done a number of other things, and more recently I've been archivist at Concordia College, working in the library there part-time.
Margaret, were you born in the Red River Valley?
No, I came from Wisconsin. I was born in northern Wisconsin, but grew up in southern Wisconsin.
I see. And were your parents, were they from Wisconsin, or did they come from someplace else?
No, they were from Wisconsin, too. We lived in one of the early settlements, the West Koshkonen area, which was one of the first settlements. My ancestors mainly came over from Norway in the 1840s and settled in that area.
Are you one of these 100% Norwegians then?
Yes, very much so.
I'd like to know a little bit about your educational background. Can you give us a little summary about it? Like, where did you attend your primary school and high school and so on in college?
For the first 4 years, I went to a rural school near my home. And then I went to a Christian day school, which was started near my home also, Lutheran Christian day school. And then I went off to high school in Stoughton, Wisconsin, which was about 8 miles away. And after I finished that, I came to Concordia College and graduated from there in 1934.
When you went away, 8 miles away from home then, did you live away from home? Did you board away from home then?
Yes, in those days there were no school buses. Today there are school buses that come through, several of them. Some pick up kindergarten children and so forth. But at that time there was no such thing as a school bus, and so the thing to do was to stay in town. And I had a sister 2 years older, and we boarded ourselves. We got a little room, and we had a little hot plate, and so we boarded ourselves. In my junior year, my brother was ready to come, and so we drove back and forth for a while in an old car, and then in the winter we stayed in town.
Well, how long were you living, boarding yourselves, from what grade to what grade?
This was in through high school, just in high school.
Oh, ninth through twelfth.
Mm-hmm.
That's still kind of young to be away from home. I suppose you went home weekends.
Yes, we went home weekends, and we also brought in enough food generally to last. We brought in a lot of boiled potatoes with their jackets, and we brought maybe cooked meat that could be kept cool and so forth.
Did you then live with another family in a room?
No, we were in an upstairs of a home, and there were two other girls in school who lived in a room on one side, and we lived in my sister and I were on the other side, and then in between there was sort of a pantry type thing, and that had a hot plate and a sink.
That's still very young. Did you have somebody to watch over you, or were you pretty much on your own?
We were entirely on our own, but there was no problem at all. The people were very friendly and sort of helped us, but we just took it for granted. I have no recollection of ever having any regulations suggested or anything else.
It's curious. Wonder what you did in the evenings. Do you remember? Did you just study?
I think we mainly studied, though we did take part. There were school activities, too, that we took part in. But I think mainly we just studied, and then we visited, of course, being four girls together. We did a lot of visiting.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. Then you came to Concordia then, and you went 4 years to Concordia.
Yes.
And what was your major then?
I majored in Latin. I'd had 4 years of Latin in high school, and so I just continued. The reason I came to Concordia, my uncle was a professor here, Herman C. Nordley, and this was during the Depression. The farmers were hit by the Depression earlier than other people, and so I had hoped to go to the University of Wisconsin, which was not far away, but then my uncle offered to lend me money for tuition and to have me work in his home for room and board, and therefore I came to Concordia.
Oh, so then you stayed at his home?
I stayed at his home all
the
time. I never stayed in the dormitory.
I see. Well, that was lucky for you then. You had that opportunity to come to Concordia College.
I should say.
Were you really active then in college, or did you work?
No, my uncle and aunt weren't too hard on me, so I did take very active part in things. Especially, my main activity was the Concordian. I was on it all 4 years, and that's the last 2 years I was managing editor, and so I spent a great deal of time there. But we also took part in many activities because it was hard to get jobs, and we were told just go into every activity you can because it will all help on your record to help you get a job.
And I'm sure you found that to be true.
Yes.
Then when you graduated from Concordia, then you had went out looking for your first job. Was it hard to find a job at
it
that time?
It was impossible at that time. I forget the percentage, but there weren't too many from our class that got jobs. This was 1934. And since I lived near Madison, then my parents said, too, well, it's foolish to just say stay home. So I went to the University of Wisconsin, and there again, I worked for my room and board. And I lived very simply, and so it cost practically nothing to get my master's degree. And when I think of what people have to go through nowadays, it's really
right.
amazing.
Well, then you just went right on then. Before
yes.
you ever did any
yes.
actually using your degree, you went
That's
on and
right.
got your master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did that take you to get that?
1 year.
1 year. And by the time that was through, then
yes.
did jobs open up then?
Yes. Then I got my first job, Western North Dakota. It was Kildare, North Dakota. And I taught English in a... Of course, the school had about 100 people in the high school, and there were four teachers, including the principal and the superintendent, and the other person was a coach, and then I taught the English classes. I'd also taught a class in art. I taught a class in typing. I had charge of girls' physical ed. I had charge of the class plays, junior and senior plays. I had charge of the school paper. And I forget what all else, but...
What did you do in your spare time?
it was very fortunate for me that when I came, there was a widow in town with several children who boarded teachers generally. And there was another new teacher, and then there was one very experienced teacher of the first and second grade, I think she had. And she was such a help because I'd never even been in a play before in my life, but she was experienced in plays. And so she was such a help, and in every way, she was such a good counselor. She would just give advice on every kind of...
Then you must have felt pretty inadequate to direct a play when you had never been in one.
Yes.
But I imagine you had attended plays and
oh
so
yes,
on.
Oh, so yes, I've
been
knew. To many plays.
Uh-huh. But you did not take part in that, in theater
no,
at all at
not
the college.
At all.
And isn't it strange that you ended up doing that also? I
yes,
suppose that went with the job.
Yes, it did.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you stay there?
I was there 1 year, and then I got a call from Mr. J.L. Rendall, who at that time was president of Waldorf College. That was a junior college of the Lutheran Church, and asked if I'd come down there to teach. So I went down there and taught English for 4 years.
I see.
No, 6 years.
Six
I was
years,
there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you came
then
here?
Then I went to library school because I'd always been very interested in library work. And at that time, my sister, who was 2 years older, had become a librarian, and she was working in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And so she said, come and stay with her, and I could go to library school. So I went to library school, got my, at that time, it was a bachelor's in library science.
I see. And then after that?
Then my first job I got was in Royal Oak, Michigan. And that was very interesting, in public library. And that was where I really noticed the difference between teaching and library work, because... As a teacher, you just get accustomed to being the ruler. I mean, you give orders and people obey them. But this in Royal Oak, the librarian there was very service conscious. And she said, you must do everything to serve the patrons. Imagine you're a shoe clerk and you're trying to get the people to buy your product. And it was a little hard for me to go from being a teacher in college to being a servant who'd want to do anything and everything to help people. That was a very good experience.
Do you think that is still true today, that librarians are...
Not in the same way. Not
to that extent.
No, not maybe. To that extent at all. And I was there just a year. She was a difficult librarian to work for, and so then the next year I went to the Detroit Public Library and worked in the catalog department, and I was there a year and a half. And that's when I got a letter to asking me if I wanted to come to Concordia.
How did that happen, that they sent you a letter?
Well, it was during the war, the librarian, Anna Jordahl was assistant librarian, and the librarian had left. He'd taken another job, and so she was alone. And it wasn't so bad while during the war because the enrollment was not very great. But as soon as the war was over in 1945, then a lot of students started coming back. Well, then they had to get help in the library. And so she wondered, she knew me slightly. I had her she taught freshman history when I was in college, so I knew her from that time. And so she talked to my uncle and said she wondered if I'd ever consider coming back, and he said, why don't you write and ask her? And it happens at the time I was just getting tired of being in a big city, because At first I thought Detroit was so exciting. There were so many things to do in these marvelous big stores. But after a while it got so, for one thing, to visit anyone or to attend any performance, you had to ride a long time on a streetcar, and to meet any friend anywhere, you rode a long time in the streetcar. And the streets seemed so dirty after being in a little town where everybody keeps everything so neat and clean. So I was quite pleased. I was quite willing. And it was a cut of, I think at that time, about $1,000 a year, which was quite a bit then, to come back. But I was just real
happy. And so that was 1945, then you came here?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And settled down at Concordia?
Yes.
And did you go in there and then as an assistant librarian?
Yes. And I also, at first I taught a little English because they were short of English teachers. And that was very interesting because I had taught freshman English, of course, at Waldorf. But I had one class of mostly servicemen, and that was very interesting. At that time, the freshman course required that you read the Iliad and the Odyssey. And those we just take for granted, but the servicemen had been around the world. They'd been a lot on the ocean and so forth, and it was also so meaningful to them, and that was just amazing to me.
You didn't have to motivate very much to get them to be interested in the Iliad and the Odyssey like you normally, I imagine, do.
Yes, it was so remote from an ordinary person's life,
right.
You know, but servicemen could understand because they had been around. And but then we started offering library science courses, and we offered quite a few different library science courses, so I taught library science courses one or two every year after that.
Mm-hmm. And you continued then at Concordia, in the library, for all these years?
Yes, except I took 4 years off, and I went to down to South Africa. I had a good friend who was a missionary there, and she said there was such a shortage of teachers, and so she suggested another friend and I come down there to teach. So we went down and taught in Zulu Lutheran High School. Actually, it was just a first and second year high school, and we taught there 3 calendar years.
Did you just get a leave of absence then from Concordia?
When I left, I got a leave of absence for 2 years. But then when we were in South Africa, we found the government was just about to take over all the mission schools and not allow any more missionaries to run schools. And one more year. And so then I wrote to then Dr. Knudsen was new, and I had just barely met him. And I wrote to him, and he said, no, you're sorry, he couldn't extend it. But I felt I just had to stay in South Africa. So I was gone for 2 more years, but when I came back, Anna Jordal was very eager to have me back, and they needed help, so I had no problem at all. I just came right back.
That must have been quite an experience to be in Africa for
4 years.
Yeah,
it was very
then.
Interesting, mm-hmm. I should say.
And did you do library work down there then?
No, I did teaching.
Teaching.
I taught mostly history, and that was so interesting because the we started with world history and then had South African history, but the Zulus were very interested in world history, and that amazed me. For example, when we studied the history of Greece and the development of democracy in Greece, you know, you just take it for granted. That's just another fact in a book. But to them, it was very real, and they wondered, how did they do it? How did they go about it? Just what were the, you know, everything involved? And that was so interesting to think that that was something they really would take.
Surprising.
Mm-hmm. But and I taught some English, too. But the one thing about the teaching there was quite similar to the British system. And they took 2 years of high school, and then they had to write a comprehensive exam on all their subjects. And so we had to spend a lot of our time studying for those exams, and you really did. In some ways, it seemed that they were learning many more things, but my good friend who was with me, Evangeline Quam from Fergus Falls, always said the American education was so much better because Americans teach you to think, while here you were mainly learning this, you know, trying to learn as many facts as you could in order to pass the exam.
When did you think about becoming a teacher? How long ago, when you were quite young? Or?
Well, all the time I thought I might be, although when I was in high school, I was very interested in geology and rocks, and I thought, oh, I would love to be a geologist. But, of course, we had one of these counseling days, and I went to see this person. I don't remember if it was a man or woman. They said, the woman can't go into that. That's no thing for a woman. You better go into teaching. That's where women should be.
So, and at that time, they were probably right.
Yes, I think that was true.
Why did you get into teaching in the beginning?
Well, it was the simplest thing to do when I came to Concordia. That was the main thing that was taught. There really wasn't, even though I was interested in library work, there really wasn't much opportunity. We just didn't hear about it. And so at Concordia, it was just assumed that the thing to do was to take teacher training and become a teacher.
I'd like to know a little bit about what Concordia was like when you started. Now, that's 1945. What was the campus like?
It was much smaller. Of course, I'd been here first in 1930 when I came to college.
That's right.
And then it was...
So you saw quite a bit of growth from 30 to 40.
Yes, there'd been... that was just in 1930. It was a small school, and the student body was very homogeneous. We were all very friendly, and you got to know everyone. And
how many were in your graduating class?
About 75, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Then when I came back in 1945, then it was just the beginning of the growth period, because we had a lot of servicemen. It was very crowded, and dormitory space was at a premium too. And so during the first year, before the second year, Dr. Brown asked me if I would be in charge of a little dormitory for girls. The house where the president lives today was purchased by the college, and in 1946, and that became a dormitory called East Hall. And we had girls there. In the second year, the home management house was moved in, and then we just had girls on the third floor. There's a large sort of what had been the ballroom that was made into dormitory style with a lot of bunk beds. And so I was in charge of those girls.
Did you live there then?
Yes, I lived there for 2-3 years.
I see. Oh.
But the college was really growing and expanding then. Mm-hmm. So.
Did you have any thought that the college would be as big as it is today? Did you see?
Well, no, it just didn't seem possible, you see, that it would ever grow much larger. Because when I was in college, even where the present Brown Hall stands was a football field. And that was about the end of the college. And I remember Gooseberry Mound, we considered was something way, way out in the country. We'd go there for picnics, and it seemed like something very far away. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, it's right in the city, and so things seem real different.
Yes. Then, when you first started teaching at Concordia, and you were working in the library, you know, you worked in the library?
Yes.
And you were teaching some, you said an English course, and then...
Then library science
courses. And then you were gone for 4 years. Mm-hmm. How long had you been at Concordia?
I came in the fall of 1945, and I left then in the summer of 1951, and I came back in the fall of 1955.
I see. Okay, then I'm sure you saw a few changes in the 4 years.
Yes, it was a much bigger school and much, it had grown in many different ways.
Uh-huh. Do you think the philosophy of the school has changed since you were a student or since you first started teaching?
I don't think so.
I think they're
stressing their purpose of training Christian people mm-hmm. to go out into the world mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm. All these years then, from 55 until you retired in 77.
Mm-hmm.
So you were there for 22 years then as a...
Actually then...
Plus?
Some 30, yes. And you see, then I came I went overseas for several years, worked in Papua New Guinea and Hong Kong. And so when I came back, 1950, then I... 1980, then I went back into archives. So I've been working in the archives.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you've had a very colorful life, haven't you?
Well, I'm very fond of travel, so...
It's wonderful. You've done a lot of wonderful things there. I would just like, again, to go back to your early days at Concordia and for you to try to reminisce a little bit about what it was like as a person on the staff compared to being a student and your feelings. Can you kind of project back there about what it was like?
Well, for one thing, of course, you had many privileges. And at that time, women didn't have apartments. We all lived in rooms. Or else when I was in the dormitory, of course, we ate in the college boarding club. But there, you see, you didn't have to stand in line. You always, there were special favors for mm-hmm. the faculty. That's mm-hmm. one thing we noticed.
Uh-huh.
That was fun.
Uh-huh. And did you mingle as a, with the faculty, with some of the people who had been your instructors then?
Yes, and I know that seems strange. One thing, Frieda Nielsen had been my English teacher, and I'd had such a, and she also was Dean of Women at the time, and she'd been so, we just looked up to her so much, and it took me many, many years before I could call her by her first name because mm-hmm. we were so used to Miss Nielsen, you know, looking up to her.
Mm-hmm.
And even though then I had come back and was really considered on a level with her.
I imagine this is one of the changes that you see at the college is the more casual.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Attitude of the students toward the instructors.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They don't have that deference paid to them so much anymore.
No.
And I'm sure when you were on the faculty, you were really looked up to by the students and the community as well.
Yes, we were considered, Although it didn't seem as much back when I was a student, then we really looked up to the faculty and considered them so important, and it was always, they called you Miss, and you know, you called them Miss or Mr.
Oh, I see.
Too.
They used your last name as a student then?
Yes, always in class. Uh-huh.
Do you remember when that changed?
Well, I don't know. It was when I first came back to Concordia. I continued to use to call my students Miss So-and-so, but I soon found, you see, that it wasn't done very much, even by that time, in the 1950s, it had changed. So,
the war probably, maybe during that time it changed.
Yeah, the war made a lot of difference, I'm sure, in changing attitudes.
What do you see as some of the problems that you had as a teacher, you know, as a young teacher at Concordia? Can you remember any, like, was your life all wrapped up in the camp, in the college atmosphere, like socially, and you pretty much mingled with faculty, Concordia faculty?
Yes, I think we did pretty much. Though right away, I was encouraged to join the American Association of University Women, and so there I got acquainted with other, there are quite a number from Morehead State who belonged to that, and quite a few of the local teachers, and that was very interesting to get acquainted with other people. And of course, later on, when I joined Delta Kappa Gamma, then I became acquainted with many of the other local teachers.
Mm-hmm. What other special duties did you have, you know, as a young teacher that normally today people wouldn't expect you to have?
I think everyone was assigned to some faculty committee, and you were expected to help with that. And I was on a religious committee. I was advisor to Mission Crusaders because I'd been working on the mission field too. And so, well, no, this was before I worked in the mission field, but when I was in college, I belonged to this organization called the Mission Crusaders. So I was very interested in it. And so that was something, it was just assumed that you would spend, it seems to me we had a meeting once a week where we would meet with students and we would talk.
Of course, that's still happening today too, isn't it? You're still serving on.
Yes, there are many people that do it, but then it was just, everyone was just automatically assigned to do some duty like that that you were expected to carry on.
And weren't you also, years ago, most people were assigned more than one discipline?
Yes.
You would teach one thing and maybe from one area and also teach.
Yes.
You never used your Latin, though, and taught
never
Latin?
Never taught. This was interesting. While I was in my senior year in college, there was a shortage. There was a call. I had taken 3 years of German in college. And there was a call to have a German teacher in Morehead High because there were four or five students that were very eager to have German. So I was asked then to come and teach, and I taught the whole year this class in German, and I got $10 a month for it, and I did that in place of practice teaching.
$10 a month?
Yes. I think it met every day, and I had this class. And I remember especially, it was a little hard for me in some ways. There were two people that were that spoke what is called Plattdeutsch, or Low German, and that was entirely new to me. And it was very difficult to argue with them, because they wanted to say all the ways they said things, and I would tell them, well, we've learned this, we're going by the book, this is the way we have to do it, and they would never quite agree with that. But that was an interesting experience.
So, and how many students did you have?
It was four or five, I think it was.
$10 a month, imagine that. So you would leave your college duties and
yes,
you had, and go
I
there every
must
day.
Have figured out my schedule some way so that I could be down there to teach this class.
Do you remember your first car?
Oh, I didn't. You see, I didn't learn to drive when I was growing up because we lived on the farm and my brothers were so eager to drive and they learned right away. So I didn't get a car till in the 60s.
Oh, I see. Well, then you had to walk then over to the high school?
Oh, yes. We walked everywhere. We walked to Fargo.
You did?
Well, there was a streetcar when I was in college. We could ride to Fargo, but we generally walked. And even at night, you could walk to Fargo at night with no problem. You could even walk alone. I had one friend who lived in South Morehead, or North Morehead, who'd walk near the river, and she walked alone almost every night home. And then the year after we graduated, my very good friend Evangeline Quam couldn't get a job teaching either, and so she took a job teaching at the Good Samaritan School, which was a school for crippled children in Fargo. And she very often walked home alone nights. She'd go over to Concordia to visit with all her friends, walk home alone at night, so that was something quite common. But even when I first came back to Concordia, I remember there, we didn't have that much entertainment. Practically nobody had a car, and so one of our favorite entertainments on Saturday was to walk to Fargo and do a little shopping and eat there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was such a big event.
Treat.
There was hardly anybody had an apartment and nobody had a car.
And then after several years, then you got yourself an apartment. After you probably didn't have to be the
Yes, when I was through
dean,
being resident head.
Resident
then.
Head, uh-huh.
Yes.
And then you got an apartment then.
Got an apartment.
I see. Uh-huh. What do you think the, we talked about the public attitude toward Concordia College and how people felt about you. What about the students, the change that you've seen? Do you see some good things that have happened as far as student attitude, or do you think it's, would you look at it in a negative way?
Oh, there are many good things about it. I can mention one, our relationship to the other colleges. Now, you probably are hearing about that from other sources too, but when I was in college, Morehead State was, it was a normal school, and we just had no connection with it. They were rivals in a way, and I think that was the reason they were competing for students, and so we simply had no use for each other, and the AC, Agricultural College, was just like a foreign, in a foreign country. It was so remote, and of course, then after the war, when there were many more students available, gradually there became much better relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until the 70s that they really started working together.
In this Tri-College?
Yes, in the Tri-College.
Mm-hmm.
And the libraries were the very very active in that movement in the at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the relationship between you and administration, or between teachers and administration? Do you see a difference at the college level, say, than at the public school level?
Yes, it was very, when I first came back to Concordia, there would be faculty meetings, and all the faculty and many of the administrators would be at the meeting. Everyone was there, and you debated things. Because for many years, the faculty at Concordia didn't want a dean to be over them. They would rather be, everyone have the right to talk to the president, and so these meetings, I used to sit at these faculty meetings and be just amazed at what the faculty would talk about, how they would argue.
With the administration, too. There
yes.
was give and take between
yes,
them.
Yes, there was a lot of give and take. You,
mm-hmm.
you certainly did have mm-hmm. direct access to the president. And now in later years, of course, today there was maybe one or two faculty meetings a year, and the faculty senate takes care of the business.
Think that's good?
Yes. Oh, yes. You never could have a very large group to take care.
Mm-hmm. Did you belong to any professional organizations, and do you now?
Well, I belonged to American Library Association all the time, and so I got a life membership in that when I retired. And I did belong to the Minnesota Library Association for many years, but I dropped that when mm-hmm. I completed my work.
But Concordia doesn't have a union kind of organization, do they?
Not for the teachers. The women had one we called the Women's League, but that was women of the faculty and faculty wives, and that was organized primarily to raise money for scholarships for the students. But that was very active. It met once a month and
mm-hmm.
had programs.
Do they still have?
No, they just disbanded. That's a change. You see, they've been having difficulty getting people to come. Everybody's so busy nowadays. So finally this year they voted to disband, and they've turned all the money over to the college, and the college is handling it. It still is called the Women's League Scholarship, but it's not operated by the Women's League anymore.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you came into the library work at a time when there's just been an explosion of materials and resources and media, right?
Yes.
And that has meant a tremendous change, I'm sure, in the library from the time you went in the 1930s to the way the libraries are set up today. Let's talk a little bit about that. What were the? How did those changes develop? And I'm sure there were a lot of problems and. As you saw the need for more and more media and just what your job would be.
Yes, as far as media is concerned, I can start after I came back to Concordia because that just didn't exist in teaching. You see, first we had a class called Books for the School Library. We had to teach for the school library. And
what do you mean? What was it? Books for the school?
Books. It wasn't book selection entirely, but it was like reference books. The course teaching all the books that the school librarian would need.
Oh, okay.
And so at first that was just books. We never thought.
Well, then you're teaching a course for people who are going to be librarians.
Yes, okay. To be school librarians. Originally, when I first came, we had 9 semester hours of library science, but later on in the 1950s, they decided they would like to offer the minor in library science, and so then we had to add many more courses. But it was interesting at first, and I also taught cataloging. And this reference course was the one that had to help with book selection. And at first, then, there was no media in it. But then after a while, we added records. I remember what a big thing that was to have records in the library. And we learned that we cataloged them. We put an orange band at the time in the top of the card to show that they were something different, because people must be sure to know they had a record instead of something else.
I imagine you don't even have a record collection anymore, do you? It's on tape now or whatever?
There still are some records, but I guess a lot of them are on tape, yes. So gradually then we added, and we called it, we didn't call it Books and Records, but anyway, it got to be more and more media. And the same with cataloging today, it's media processing. But we kept adding, you know, first there were just a little bit audiovisual added, and then more and more. And the same was true in the reference collection. At first, in your reference work, you basically worked with books and studied encyclopedias and reference books, but later then you... And so that was just a tremendous change. And then, of course, duplicating made such a difference, as Xeroxing your books. And when you think now that students have access to such a tremendous amount of material, it's just no question about... When I was in college, and even when I first came back, if a student wanted to write a term paper, he went to the library and took 3-4 books, and he looked up half a dozen articles in the Reader's Guide, in the obvious, maybe Newsweek or something, and took some notes on it, and you wrote a report. Of course, now you have access to just an indefinite amount of material, and you can get Xerox copies of as many articles as you want, and you can borrow books from practically anywhere. And so it just made such a tremendous difference. I'm not sure whether, well, maybe it is better in some ways. I'm sure the person that learns a great deal more, but whether they're learning to make use of it as well, I don't know, really.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it makes it much more complex job to be in library work today. You even have to know how to run machines.
And take care
of them.
Just toward the end of my work in cataloging, the Tri-College got going, and we decided to make a tape to have a joint catalog for our three libraries, and then we joined the OCLC, and that was the last year.
What's OCLC?
At that time, it was the Ohio College Learning Center, something like that. It has a slightly other name, but that was a way of computerizing cataloging, and so we started then putting all our cataloging on the computer. And then it was available to the Tri-College. And later on, this happened after I left, that because the State Universities of Minnesota went into joint cataloging, and that Concordia was able to join too because of being Tri-College, and so we have then the computer terminal and have access to the books in the...
Do you have a checkout system now that is on computers too?
We haven't changed our computer system. They're talking about it all the time, but we haven't changed that as yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, then the library, of course, had to expand.
Yes.
Because of the media. Now, where was the library first located?
When I was in college, it was in the end of the building, which is now Bishop Whipple. And it was located there from, well, when they first had moved out of a room in the old main building. But then during the war, there was a period where Concordia was to have a unit of servicemen to come to work to study here. So then it was decided that the library should be moved into the basement of Felsted Hall. So that was done, and there the servicemen decided they didn't like it there anyway, and they packed up and went over to Morehead State. But it was a good thing that the library was moved, and it was in the basement of Felsted Hall for many, many years.
And you worked there then?
I worked there then, and one thing about it was that there were just window wells, and so most of your light was interior light, and you wouldn't have the slightest idea what the weather was like outside. When you were working all day and you go outside and it's either storming or blizzarding or raining, or you had no idea what the weather was like outside. And so then the college had been hoping to build a library. Dr. Brown had tried to build a library in the 1930s, but he couldn't get enough money. In the 1940s, he tried and he couldn't get enough money. And finally then in 1955, the college had gotten so far. It was expanding, so many more students and growing and so forth. And so they did build a new building, and that's when the C-400 Club was established. There was one of our alumni, Luther Jacobson, and a businessman, Eugene Paulson, got together and said, "No, we want to figure out a way of paying for that library." And so they thought if they could get 1,000 people to, or 400 people to pay $1,000 each. That would pay $400,000 for the library. And they did. And, of course, the after the library was paid for, this C400 Club went on to add many, many more. But anyway, it was a tremendous thing to move to this new library.
What year was that again?
1956 is when we moved. Now, I came back in 1955, you see, and then the plans were, it was just 1 year that I was in the old place. And it was quite an undertaking to move all the books in the library. And it was, to save the expense of hiring movers, it was all organized.
Kids, didn't they?
Yes, we did.
I remember that.
We went through, we measured all the shelves in the old library and all the shelves in the new library, and then we figured out where everything should go. And so we marked all the places where things should go in the new library. And then we had students, two different sections, and they went, they took a pile of books with a number on it and took it over to the other library. And somebody received it, and the books were put right in shelf, and so the next day we could go on.
Imagine that.
Yes, it was really some undertaking.
Now, has that library expanded? It's been big
yes.
enough?
No, it got to be too small, too, and so they added an addition to it in 1970 or 71.
Mm-hmm. Because of the media, I imagine, is what
yes.
really takes up the
oh,
space.
Oh, yes,
and
it does.
Uh-huh. And so now the library, then, is... right in the center of the campus, really, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's a good
mm-hmm.
location there.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you worked in there in that new library then, and in the same
yes.
job capacity then.
Yes, I was. Well, I got different titles, but when I finally finished, I was a professor of library science, and I also was called catalog librarian.
I see. Mm-hmm. And you had students working for you too, I suppose.
Yes, we had many.
You had
and
a train.
Yes, that was such a change too. When I first came, we'd have one or two students maybe come in for a short time each day. But and we kept adding more and more students, and so that we'd have quite a few students working there. And today they have about 60 students working in the library. I don't know how many work in processing, but a great many.
Mm-hmm. And just before the building was built, when you were in Felsted Hall in the basement there,
mm-hmm.
then that was where the library was during the war.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the campus was quite small, mostly
yes.
women.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That must have been a different atmosphere then during the war.
Because I wasn't here then, you see. I came back in the fall of
45. Oh, that's right.
So I just have heard about it. You know,
oh,
that
that's
was
right. Mm-hmm.
Mostly women, but there were
you
enough
were teaching someplace else at that time.
I was in library work, you see. I was in Waldorf. I left Waldorf in 1942 and worked in libraries and until 1945.
In public libraries.
Yes, public libraries in Michigan.
I see. Okay. Did you do anything, do you remember during the war effort at all? Did you... Were you involved in any activities there?
No, I don't think we did anything special.
You were busy with your
special.
Library work, I guess.
Yes, we did at the Royal Oak Public Library, where we were to serve as much as possible. We did try to look up and find as much information for people
yeah.
about the war as we possibly
uh-huh.
could.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't really do anything special.
So you came in the fall of
1945,
and the war had just been over then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the, so all the servicemen came.
Yes.
And there must have been quite a number of new faculty then.
Yes, there were.
So there must have been
a
kind of an excitement around the campus
yes.
at that time with several, I suppose, 100 maybe new students?
I think several hundred.
Yeah.
Because they at first they didn't have dormitory space. They were building Brown Hall, and I don't know if that was ready. Anyway, one year they had... they turned the gym into a boys' dormitory, and for about a month or so, the boys had to live in bunks in the gym
uh-huh.
before they could
uh-huh.
go into their regular
uh-huh.
places.
I know, Margaret, you've been really involved in other things in the community, as well as mm-hmm. You know, being an educator and a librarian at Concordia College. What are some of the things that you've been involved in?
Well, I was especially active in the church, and originally we had a group for young women called the Lutheran Daughters of the Reformation. I was active in that in Trinity Church, and then I later was president of the Northern Minnesota District, which is the northern half of Minnesota. So then at the time of the church merger in 1960, I went into the American Lutheran Church Women, and I was first a vice president and then the president of the Northern Minnesota District of that. And that meant going to there would be a workshop once a year and a convention once a year and then a number of board meetings. And then later I was on the national LDR board, ALC, the American Lutheran Church Women. I was elected to be a member of large on the national board. I was on that for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was very interesting.
And you still continue to be quite active.
Yes.
In many things. You must have good health.
Yes, I've been very fortunate. I'm still in excellent health.
Uh-huh. You also were involved in these professional organizations. Did you take part as an officer in those organizations, too?
In the American Association of University Women, I was an officer, and locally I was local president. I also was on the state board as an area representative for several years, and also we had what is called a corporate representative for the college, and so I was that for quite a number of years, mm-hmm. to the state,
mm-hmm.
convention and the state department board. It was called a division, I guess.
Mm-hmm. There has been some talk, it crops up every now and then, about censorship, and particularly when it comes to books and banning books. I mean, did mm-hmm. you ever get involved in anything like that?
Oh, we were always quite careful. It was interesting. I'd have to teach it, too, you know, so we would make a study of it. But at Concordia, we generally were very careful about not putting controversial books into the library, just because we didn't really see that. Well, nobody demanded them, I guess. It's different now today. Any book that anybody needs, I think, would be purchased. But I remember they used to be quite particular. I remember the librarian had the Decameron even was kept in closed shelves. And anything that there might be trouble about, it would kept in closed shelves so that you wouldn't find out who took it. And that there is some advantage in that. At least if they cut pictures out of something, then you have a little control over it to find out what has happened.
Uh-huh.
The Concordian was something. While I was in college, I remember we were supervised very strictly, and the newspaper was really more of a publicity feature for the college. You didn't say anything unfavorable. Well,
the newspaper you're talking about.
Yes, the newspaper, the Concordian.
Concordian, yes.
But, of course, then later that, in more recent years, of course, that had a problem. And there was one year, it was under Dr. Knutson. I forget, it was in the 50s, I think, sometime, that somebody put in an ad for abortion. And so he closed the paper. And they had a lot of discussion. There's a lot of correspondence, a lot of arguments and so forth.
Nobody protesting, though, with student demonstrations and that sort of thing?
I don't remember that. No. We never had too many demonstrations on.
Did you have some, though?
There were some, but one thing that was fortunate about Concordia, and sometime, I forget just when, they went on what they called a trimester, and so the middle semester ended at the end of April, and it seems a great many of college demonstrations are in May, like the Kent State and other things.
Interesting.
Because, well, May, it's the weather, you know, that's a funny thing to say, but it seems the weather has something to do with that. Because generally, so many of the college protests and demonstrations have been in May, and Concordia didn't have anything except a small summer school at that time, mm-hmm. and that was one thing that I think that saved.
Concordia was not involved in civil rights movements and that sort of thing, and demonstrations in the 70s, like we talk about the 70s, the kids of the 70s mm-hmm. in colleges. It was pretty mild then on the campus.
It was quite mild. They did have certain times when they had demonstrations. I heard Mr. Rendall telling the other day about when they had a prayer vigil of some kind. Every day they'd meet on the campus outside, very obviously. I forget what they were praying for. It was some version of civil rights. And for then the black students had a protest at one time, but that too was on the campus. They didn't go off the campus, and they didn't take over any buildings. They would just have
Now, there was a time when the black students came almost en masse. A large group mm-hmm. of black students were brought in from the South, right?
Yes.
What was the purpose?
Well, everyone felt that we should try to... it was after the civil rights movement, if everyone felt that there should be more opportunities for blacks. I know we made a study. I worked on that in 1969. I prepared quite a long bibliography of all the books in the library that had anything to do with the blacks. And we just had never paid any attention to them before.
Mm-hmm. But we just don't have them here, that's why.
Yeah, but we did discover, of course, when you look around and find all literature that has even black characters in it and so forth. And so...
Were you looking for discrimination in books, too?
Not looking for discrimination, just looking for the information.
Oh, I see.
So that we had a complete listing of mm-hmm. everything. And then we did try to buy, we did try to fill in and buy books that mm-hmm. would be good
mm-hmm.
ones.
Mm-hmm. Then there were some problems then during the time when the blacks came in. for a while. How long did that period last when this happened, this attempt was made?
I don't remember. It seemed like it was several years.
I know there was a house for the blacks.
Yes, yeah. That was one of their protests when they asked for a house. And then later they did get a small house that was later torn down. But they also wanted a black studies department. And that was very difficult at Concordia because there just wasn't a need for it. And the college just couldn't afford to bring in very many people that could teach in that field.
That was almost like an experiment, wasn't it, to do this?
Yes, it would seem like.
Then they don't do this anymore.
No, we don't really hear much. Once in a while we hear someone say there is some discrimination. I'm sure there is in some cases too, but it isn't a problem anymore.
Do you have black students on campus now?
Yes, we have a few. It was while we were trying to get large numbers that we really had problems, because many came then who had no religious background. And so they just didn't want to fit in. They didn't want to abide by our rules
and
so forth.
Yes, and Concordia has had quite a history of rules and regulations.
Yes.
Have those now, I'm sure you've seen a progression and a change and a lightening up of some of these rules?
Yes, they were very, very strict. Back when I was in college, even though I didn't stay in the dormitory, I knew about them. There you had to be in. Like the freshmen had to be in the dormitory by 7 o'clock, and the other students had to be there at 10 o'clock, and you could only go to the library at night if you had a permit. And weekends, maybe they could stay out till 11 o'clock, but they had to sign out when they left and sign in when they came back and so forth. And that gradually eased up.
They didn't seem to object to that, though. It seemed to be expected, wasn't it?
Back in those days, students took it for granted because their parents still had enough influence on them.
Right.
And their parents wanted that sort of treatment.
Mm-hmm. And there were other regulations as to, were there dress codes, for example?
I don't remember that we had anything very strict, but I'm sure. I know for one, Dr. Knudsen hated to see women wearing pants until finally it got to be a period of the very short skirts. Then he said now he changed. He saw with all those short skirts, he decided that it would be all right to let the girls wear pants.
Yes, I remember when I was first teaching that we couldn't wear slacks.
Yes.
And then we finally got a bulletin that said you can wear slacks, but you must wear a jacket that matched.
Oh,
you have to have a pants suit, in other
yes.
words. And so times have changed in that area.
Oh, very much.
All over the country. And so then there probably weren't many stated dress codes, but people simply did dress appropriately, and that was probably the way it was when you were going to college.
Yes. Well, we had talks. The dean of women would talk to us quite often about manners. You must wear a hat to church. You could not go to church without a hat, and usually you should have gloves, too. And even when we came back, because I remember even when I first joined Delta Kappa Gamma, you had to wear a hat and gloves to... I think it was to initiation and to any dinners you had, and so or teas or whatever.
Yes, uh-huh.
So they used to be very strict. But there, I don't know that you would be punished. I think you just didn't fit
maybe
in.
Maybe someone talked to you or something.
I think they probably did call people in and talk
appropriate.
To them. Yes, that probably was it.
Uh-huh. Can you think of any other rules besides the evening hours and so on that they had that were that they've had to lighten up on, or they've chosen to?
Well, I'm sure they were not allowed to show any kind of affection in public. I mean,
how about smoking, for example?
Oh, well, that, of course, was for a very long time. Girls were not allowed to smoke. And that continued. I don't know when that let up, but I think girls were not allowed to smoke, it seems to me, up into the 60s. You know, it was quite late before that was changed at Concordia.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still, even then, I suppose there were certain places you couldn't smoke. You couldn't
yes.
smoke in classrooms, I imagine.
No, no, that was...
In certain areas, you know. And drinking.
Yes, they were always very strict on that.
Is that still...
Well, they say so, but they don't really try... They can't enforce it the way you used to. But any obvious thing, they certainly try to take care of. But back in the early days, you know, you'd be expelled. See, I work in the archives, and I've been reading the letters back in the 20s and the 30s when... children were expelled because they were either even going to a dance. You see, you weren't allowed to go to a dance. And there were a couple students that had gone to this dance, and they had a public dance hall, and they hadn't even danced. They just stood there and watched, and they were expelled because the parents would write pleading letters and say, just can't you give my child another chance? And And then the president would write and say, well, we have to enforce our principles, and we feel the only way to uphold the standards is to... But they would let them come back to school the next year, usually, if they
imagine
were expelled.
Imagine that.
Yes, doesn't that seem extreme?
And what year was that letter written?
Sometime in the 1920s, I think. It was Dr. Brown. He came in 1925, and so I think mainly that's when it was in the 20s that he wrote those letters.
Oh, that's amusing.
But when I was in college, too, anybody who was caught drinking was certainly expelled. And smoking was... even the boys weren't supposed to smoke in the dormitory or anywhere except off campus, I guess. But it used to be quite a double standard. There was never the strict supervision and application of rules to the boys. And now it's different, of course. Mm-hmm. You get much more equality on that point of view.
Do you remember what your salary was when you first started at Concordia?
I can't think. My first year of teaching at Kildare, North Dakota, I got $75 a month for 9 months. It was only a 9-month contract, and I thought that was a marvelous salary. I was just thrilled this could be to get it. When I came to Concordia, I suppose it was probably about $2,200 or $2,500 or something like that, and that was for 12 months. We had library work was for 12 months with 2 weeks of vacation.
So you worked all your time then, really, as a 12-month person.
Yes. Later on, we got a month of vacation in the library. Mm-hmm. That was sometime in the 60s, and after that, it was a month. Yes. But otherwise, it was a full
different
year.
Different than the staff.
Yes, the regular teachers are just to teach during the 9 months.
And I suppose you had very little fringe benefits when you started out teaching.
Yes, I don't remember.
Did you have insurance or...
I don't remember. At Concordia, at first they had, I don't remember we had any medical plan at all. I think it just belonged to something like Blue Cross. But they were, it was up to your superior on sick leave, and that was very generous. Mm. So they're very good about that. But later on then, Concordia went into to a big group medical plan. Mm-hmm. It was Massachusetts Mutual, and of course that was just a tremendous improvement over what had been before.
Did you ever have need of any long-term medical or needed care insurance? Did you ever have to use yours?
I don't recall. I had a few surgeries, but they were very short things, so I don't...
I know years ago, many times people would just lose everything they had because of an illness or something. They weren't insured, and there were no fringe benefits from their job and so on.
No, in Concordia, too, and somewhere in the 50s, I think, they added this... some kind of a policy whereby if you became ill and couldn't work, you got your benefits for half a year or a year or something like that. Mm-hmm. So they did add a very good policy there.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any memorable encounters you've had with students or any, do you still keep in contact with any of your former, young people that you got to know at the college?
We still hear from quite a number. They come in to visit whenever they come to town.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to think of very specific cases. Mm-hmm. One that I really enjoyed was an older student, a Concordia graduate, who was teaching in Lake Park, started coming in to take library science. We taught it in the summer sometimes. There'd be a demand from when there first got to be an interest in having librarians in the schools. Then she came in to take the courses, and it was so much fun to have an adult who had been working in a school library.
Who knew what you wanted to learn,
yes,
I'm sure.
And so that was one very, and so that's a very happy experience that I keep up to the present time.
Sure. I'd like to know a little bit about what you've been doing now since 1977. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, it goes back to when my friend Vangeline Kwam and I taught in South Africa. We always said when we retired, we were going to overseas to do something. Well, she was teaching in Fergus Falls, and the discipline, Fergus Falls had been a very good town for teaching, but toward the later years, the discipline got difficult. So she decided to retire at 62, and she went to Papua New Guinea and taught in a teacher's college there. So when I was ready to retire, I didn't want to leave early, but when I was ready to retire, then she said, you must come to Papua New Guinea. Well, the only way I could do that was under World Brotherhood Exchange, which is a volunteer program. So I went and worked in a seminary library there for 5 months, and that was very interesting working. I just mostly did recataloging. Well, then when I came home, I caught hepatitis. We went traveling all over the country, and it was, you know, not a very sanitary country, not set up for travelers at all. And so I caught hepatitis, but it was a mild case. So after I recovered from that, then I got a call from our church mission office, and they said, we really need a librarian in Hong Kong because the librarian there, a Chinese lady, wants to come to the United States to get her library degree. And so I went there to be in charge of the library, but I had a Chinese assistant. About half the books were English and half were Chinese. And so I had a Chinese assistant who did all the Chinese books. And at the end of that year, then the Kowloon Lutheran Middle School, which was grade 7 through 11, needed a librarian because the librarian was leaving to get married. And so I stayed there and worked in that library for a year.
And where was that?
That in the, that in room? Hong Kong. No, that was in Hong Kong too. Kowloon Lutheran.
Oh, so you were there 2 years then?
So I was
in
there
Hong
2 years. I did a little teaching there the first year at the seminary. They did have a class in English for people that weren't very good in English. And so I got three students who were very very poor in English. So it was almost like personal tutoring. And that was lots of fun, but they had difficulty. Chinese doesn't have the grammar set up that English does. And so I had one boy, that very capable boy. He's a leader in every way, but he could not understand grammar at all. He could not see I could never get across what a subject and a verb was, or a part of speech, or any kind of construction. He simply could not see. And he didn't really need English, because they weren't required to learn English at the seminary. They could become. They were required to learn the two Chinese languages, the Mandarin, which is the official language.
Now, the seminary, was this
it's
a Christian seminary?
It was a Lutheran seminary.
It was.
Mm-hmm. And they had about 50 students that were studying. Not all of them were studying to be pastors. They had a number of women who were studying to be ministers of education. Sorry, they still were not allowing women to become pastors in Hong Kong when I was there. But the women could take training and be then education directors.
Now, this was what year now?
This was 1979 to 80.
And then
78 to 79. Because 79, 78 to 79 is as I was at the seminary. And then the next year I was at the middle school.
Okay, and then so you left and came back here to?
In 1980.
Morehead in 1980. Mm-hmm. And then is that when you started
working
in archives?
In the fall I started working in archives. Yeah.
Now that, to me, sounds really fascinating. As working in the archives, what are you doing? What is
Well, I'm arranging. See, all the time at Concordia in the library, someone was seeing that all the old material relating to Concordia was being saved, and it was boxed up and put into some rooms on the third floor of the library. And but we did do some all the time. I was cataloging. I did catalog things that the college publications and whatever seemed it should belong in archives, and then what we all we had, we didn't have any archives room, we just had a section in the librarian's office. So when I came back, there were just, you know, two rooms full of boxes of things, a lot of duplicate material too, but lots of old, it was all old and new, all mixed up together. And so I've been organizing that, especially the pictures. There's a great interest in the old pictures of the college, but also
and then you've been reading these interesting letters then from graduates and from parents, and you get an idea, I'm sure, about the atmosphere of the college and the whole history, right?
Yes, I've been trying to get things in order, especially from the early years, because Concordia's centennial comes in 1991, and we're going to have a history written. And now one of our history professors, Carol Engelhardt, is starting to work on the first 20 or 25 years. And so I'm trying
to. Isn't he getting a leave now to do this?
Yes, next semester he's going to work on it.
Have there been any surprises as you've been reading some of the things that have?
Well, there are different things that are a little different. Let's see if I can think of just what would be the most. In the early days, the correspondence, or a lot of the material, was in Norwegian.
Oh.
But at the same time, Norwegian was not encouraged at Concordia. They were, when in the early days, many people that came to Concordia were recent immigrants from Norway, and they wanted to learn English, and so they were encouraged to learn English. But for some reason, the early minutes of the boards and so forth were kept in Norwegian.
They were too,
and that was a little surprising.
That is surprising, right?
Yes. But also, there was a very close connection between the church and the college. The when there were there one big fund drive, 1926 to 28, that I've been working with quite a bit, was an endowment drive. And that was organized through the church in Torley. They called in the leaders of the districts and the circuits, and they had the Northern Minnesota District and all of North Dakota. And then they called in all the presidents of all the circuits, which are conferences. They were called conferences sometimes and circuits sometimes. Mm-hmm. And every pastor then was supposed to contact all the people in his congregations and find out if they would give to Concordia. And they have lots of these lists, and then they would write in and say what problems they had. And then in the it was quite successful, because in the early, in the middle 20s, things were still going pretty good. But then toward the latter part of the 20s, times were getting to be quite hard for farmers. And so then there's so many letters saying, we're sorry, we just can't pay our pledge this year because we just didn't have any crops, and we don't know if we'll get crops next year or whatever. And so it's very interesting. It's really sort of a key to the agricultural situation of that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically the people that came to Concordia were from small towns and from farms.
Mm-hmm. Is Concordia the oldest college of the Lutheran colleges?
No, it isn't. Luther College is the oldest one. That was organized quite early. And then the second one was St. Olaf College. And Concordia came in 1891, which is
so
at least 10 or maybe 15, 20 years older, earlier or later. Than St. Olaf.
Yeah. Then as this in this work as archivist, I guess that's what you would call it, you have anything that was in files, I suppose, that rather than discard, they just put it in the archives.
Yes.
All the communications and all the newspapers, are they there too?
We have all the newspapers. Actually, I don't have a great many of the college records are still in the offices and in the vaults relating to the administration, because we just have a room that's built out of plywood out of the top of the library. It's not very secure, and it's not climate controlled, really.
Oh.
So it's not too good, but I'm trying to put everything into what we call the Hollinger box, which is an acid-proof box to try to preserve.
Then is it your job to decide what belongs in the box and what does not?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's your job then to discard duplicates?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And to put it in some kind of, is it a sequential kind of an order then?
A lot of it is in order by a time. Let's see, I'm rearranging everything by what we call record groups, and I got that from the library. The archivist at St. Olaf worked out a system for St. Olaf that I'm following quite a bit. For example, the first record group is material relating to the college in general, the anniversaries and the history and so forth. And the next group is the governing bodies, and that was originally we had board of directors and board of trustees, and later it became the board of regents. The third group is the presidents, and that is for each president. Then we have a file. And for Dr. Brown, I have the most correspondence. I think the later correspondence must still be over in the president's office.
Right.
And then there's another for treasures. I have quite a number of the really early treasures books, and showed, you know, how the amounts of money, of course, are just fabulous. How little everything costs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any examples, but it's just, you know, the prices were so low.
I'm sure, Margaret, you're really being feel proud that you've been a member of the Concordia faculty all these years, and
yes,
and been at the.
It's a real inspiration, and one advantage, of course, we always went to chapel in the old days. Everybody went to chapel, including the faculty. You were expected to, but you really got marvelous both sermons and informational talks of all kinds. So that
it's been a growing. Something you've been able to grow spiritually intellectually.
Very much so.
As part of the Concordia campus life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any regrets?
Oh, I've wasted so many years. I wish, I've got so many things at home. That's why I want to stay home now. I'm a great saver of everything, and I always intend to do more. And if I only could have made myself really get organized years and years ago, I would have been much better off if I could have learned to throw things that should be thrown and to organize the things that should be kept.
And so that's your next goal, I suppose, now?
Mm-hmm.
I understand that you are retiring now?
Yes, this summer when I...
You haven't made a formal...
Yes, I wrote to the president. I said I hope to finish by the end of May, but actually I'm not sure if I'll get everything strictly in order. But I will continue during the summer.
But you are going to now then?
Yes, and so now I'm working quite frantically trying to get things in order. As I just The topic I'm working on now is the faculty, all the papers of the faculty. And it happens, the person who wrote the first history of Concordia, called Cobber Chronicle, was on our faculty and also a graduate, Erling Rolfshoed. And he turned over boxes and boxes of papers that have to do with preparing the Cobber Chronicle. So I've just been working on those and getting them in order somewhat.
And then, so you retiring me. What are your plans now, then, after that? Besides organizing, you said you have all your paperwork and so on.
Well, I'm also working on family history, and I'm very interested in it, but I haven't really had enough time.
In your own family history?
My own family history. On my father's side, we have it in book form and so forth, but on my mother's side, there's so much left to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm archivist at Trinity Lutheran Church, and I haven't done too much there. They have lots of material, too, that should be gone through and organized better, and so I'm hoping to put some time on that now, too.
And since you've been a traveler all your life, I imagine you've got travel plans in the future, too.
I'm not so sure. My friend Evangeline Quam in Fergus Falls just loves to travel, and every year she goes at least two trips. In January and February, she was in Egypt and Morocco. She's been in China twice. I've been in China once. And she always, every year, she says, oh, let's go here, let's go there. But I don't manage. She goes every year somewhere. Now, one place she wants me to go with her next year will be the 100th anniversary of the founding of the church in Papua New Guinea. And so she said, oh, we must go there. And we can also, I've been to Australia briefly and New Zealand, but she said, oh, we should go down there again. So I might do that, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. It's been interesting talking to you, Margaret. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that we haven't touched on? You have had a very interesting life. I'm sure you've got a lot of more interesting years ahead of you.
Well, I don't really know. I tried to write down some notes. One thing, while I was in South Africa, I learned to write mimeographed letters to send home, and ever since I've written a yearly letter at Christmas. And that was such a help. I went back through that, and that's one reason I can help. I can remember
as
many things.
You kept every letter, huh?
Yes, I kept an example of every letter.
Well, that was a good idea.
But there would be some years I'd be too busy, and that really was sad. You know, now when I see it, if I only had I'd just write a poem. I wanted to be a writer originally. Oh, that's another thing I'm interested in. I used to think I wanted to be a writer, and I took some real interesting courses at the University of Wisconsin in summer school on writing. And then I've kept diaries all the time I've been overseas, so I've got so many diaries. So I'm hoping maybe I'll...
Maybe you can still write a book.
Well, I might. I would like to maybe... I'm going to an elder hostel at Concordia. I just feel too busy to go anywhere else, but they're going to have a class in computer. And so I'm thinking I'd like to get a word processor, and I'd like to get my diaries, at least for my nieces and nephews. They say they would like to see them.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the interesting things that have happened to you and all the places you've been, it would really be good reading, I would think.
Well, the one thing I learned, the one course that I took was called at Wisconsin, was called Writing and Selling Feature Articles. And you had to write, you had to sell two articles, and then you could get an A in the course. Well, I did that. I sold two articles. You know, one was about, I interviewed a professor about apples. He was a horticulture professor, and the other one was about the city of Madison had planted it was very early at that time. They covered over a garbage dump and made it into a park. So I wrote that up. But I discovered then there's a great deal of work to it.
Yes.
And I decided I'm not, you know, there really is a lot
and
of work.
Discipline.
You really have to apply yourself and do revising all the time and so forth. And so I sort of gave up on that. But maybe I can come back to that now.
As we close this interview, I did ask you if you had any regrets, and you really didn't have very many. And I'm just going to toss this one. You might have something about any words of wisdom for young people going into pursuing the same type of career that you have pursued. Anything that you would like to?
Not too much, except I do think that it's better not for people to specialize too much, because in all my experience, I found that everything I've ever learned anywhere has come to be of value later on. So I think the more you can branch out and have interests in other fields and just learn as much as you can about all kinds of topics, the better off you are.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Margaret.
Yes, you're welcome.